My name's Chris Kirk, and this is TW Talks, the interviews podcast from Free Weeks Edinburgh. I am at the Edinburgh Festival 2025. I'm sitting in the club bar at Assembly George Square, right at the heart of the fringe, and I'm going to be talking to performers who are appearing at this year's festival, talking past, present, and future, their journey in comedy to date, this year's show, and what is happening next. Today, Jesse Nixon, whose show Don't Make Me Regret This is on at Assembly George Square this festival. Let's get TW talking with Jesse. So we are still in the lounge at the Assembly Club Bar. More guests coming in to talk about their shows at Edinburgh Festival 2025. My next guest is already here talking to Jesse Nixon. Thank you for joining us.
Hello.
And we will be talking about your show, Don't Make Me Regret This. But before we get to this year's show, past, present and future. So let's talk about your journey in comedy so far. So let's start at the start. When did you decide that getting up on stage and doing comedy was what you wanted?
Well, I managed to get all the way through university without joining Comedy Society, apart from the very first last week when I was due to graduate. And I just was like, let me go one time to get off the bucket list. And I went. They offered me a gig. I did a gig. I'm sure it was atrocious. Everyone's first gigs were. But it was enough for me to get the bug. And then I went back to Bristol and I kind of stalked the open mic scene in the way that everybody does and went to see a few gigs. And then I think also in the way that a lot of people encounter, my thought was some of this isn't very good. And hubristically, I believe that I could do it better if given a little bit of time. And so then I started asking for spots. And thank God, I mean, I'm still in touch with the couple of people that did give me my first spot. Mr. David Hoare, who's a fringe veteran himself, gave me my first proper spot. Yeah.
So that's interesting. So, yeah, because a lot of people, university is where there's the Improv Society or some comedy stuff, but it was literally right at the end that it was sort of like, let's have a go.
Yeah, and I think it's probably really informative on the type of act you become, because the people I know that did comedy at uni were allowed to be so experimental because they were just doing it to their peers and their friends. Whereas I feel like, because I had to start impressing members of the public out the gate, it's made me be a bit less experimental, but a bit more kind of clubby and sort of gag oriented.
And when you started doing the open mic scene, Bristol, you said, was where you were sort of starting out. And was it immediately obvious to you the kind of comedy you wanted to do? Or was it something you were very much learning as you were on stage as you go?
I think probably I did. I can't remember now, but I don't think I was like, I'm going to be the next Maria Bamford or whatever. I do think in Bristol in particular, there was a group of us that all started out at the same time. We were all way more hardworking and took it way more seriously than we needed to, given our status as open micers at the time. But it was really helpful because we were all a little bit, we were very supportive, but very competitive with each other. And if somebody was smashing because they'd written a new five, you'd be like, oh God, now I have to go and write a new five in order to keep up with this person. And that was really helpful in terms of getting us all kind of good quickly.
And in that early phase when you started doing it, to what extent was it something you enjoyed doing? And to what extent was it, do you know what, I'm going to try and make a career out of this?
Oh, 100% the first one. I don't think anybody in their right mind thinks about it making a career for a while. Especially, again, we had some really good acts in Bristol who were the ones that did the paid gigs and the pro gigs. And then there was a clear delineation between those guys and us guys, and it was like, well, you're not good enough yet, and we were all like, yeah, we're definitely not, you know. And so I think all of us were just in it to be as good as possible for us for a long time. But I would say, because it wasn't London, paid work was on the horizon a bit more quickly and a bit more clearly than the London open mic scene.
I mean, that's an interesting thing, isn't it, that if you look around the UK, London is the epicenter of so much, including sort of the more corporate end of the comedy industry. And there's lots of great comedy nights and opportunities in London. But there's also a huge amount of people trying to make it.
Oh, yeah.
And so actually, when you've got cities, and I guess there's a relatively small number, but there is a small number of other cities which have a vibrant enough scene that you can get something going, but not quite so much competition that, as you say, it just feels like those paid slots are you know, years away.
Exactly. That's why I have always said I think Bristol is the perfect city to start out in. It's like a mini London. You know, there are loads of opportunities. There are a few famous people knocking about. You might accidentally find yourself on a gig with Russell Howard or whatever if he's coming to do new material, but yeah, it's not, it doesn't feel like a mirage in the way that paid work feels in London for new acts.
So you said at the start it was very much a passion in those early days. Was there a sort of a moment or a sort of a short period of time where you started to think, actually, no, this is starting to build momentum now, I can start making money from this?
I think so. In as far as you can make money from comedy, I'm still yet to encounter the moment where I go, I can comfortably keep myself alive from just this, with no supplementary kind of comedy adjacent stuff like voiceover or whatever. But no, I remember my first real proper paid gig, or I probably had little ones before that, but I remember being offered £100 to feature on Russell Howard and Friends in Lakota Gardens during the pandemic. It was an outdoor gig, and it was me, comedian Stuart Goldsmith, and Russell Howard. And that was a huge... And I remember I also went to Alton Towers that day with my boyfriend at the time. And it's just like the best day of my life to this day, to go to Alton Towers and then go and support Russell Howard for good money in the evening during the pandemic when everything kind of feels like it's meant to be rubbish. It was just the best.
And as things progress, obviously the challenge is you do those open mic spots, you start doing the sort of the club spots, and slowly but surely you're doing longer sets.
Yeah.
And how did you find from going from like the 5 minute to the 10 to the 20? How, and because I guess it's with that more time, you can sort of experiment more with the form. It doesn't have to be quite so much punchline, punchline, punchline.
Yes. Well, you say that, but I think a lot of people, myself included, fell into the trap of like, I'll just elongate my 10 into 15 and then chuck in 5 minutes of crowd work and there's my club 20. And that doesn't fly, especially in Bristol. You're doing, I mean, I think most Bristolian acts, our first 20s were in like Devon or Newport or places like that, where it's like kind of tough crowds, older crowds, rural crowds. They're not going to understand all of your like hippity hoppity young people references. And so I think, yeah, they're for sure, all of us had a time where we, oh my God, my alleged club 20 is not clubby enough, is not good enough. And I think it's down to charity on behalf of local promoters that we were allowed to keep doing them to an extent. But it did make us get better quickly, because it's horrible to die on your ass in Barry for 20 minutes. So.
And then I guess the really big leap, and in the UK, because of Edinburgh, it's a big part of it, the really big leap is going to that hour. So tell us about the journey from you know, doing the full hour show.
Oh, well, I feel like I've only just mastered the hour. Literally like probably 5 days was when I was like, I can comfortably carry an audience through an hour of material. I'd done 45 minutes in 2023, but I hadn't really taken it very seriously. I hadn't been like working on it actively or kind of seeking ways to improve it. And I also think my stamina on stage is way better in terms of my ability to maintain an energetic persona over the course of an hour, as well as I think you can be energy, energy, energy for an hour. But I also think it's nice if you can imbue some calmer moments, some light and shade. So for me, I've been doing poems in my show because it's like gag, 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 high energy, shouting, diddler. And then it's quite nice with change of lighting. We've got... It would be a haze machine, but I didn't want to pay for it. So it's actually some Batiste dry shampoo that I spray into the air to make it.
It does the job?
It does the job. It was £5. And that gives a really nice sense of kind of differentiation. I think I'd rather watch a high energy hour than a low energy hour. But I think even a high energy hour, you don't want to leave feeling exhausted, you know? It's nice to have some variation.
No, I always remember years ago, I interviewed Susan Kalman here at The Fringe. And she talked about the hour show and how... I think what she said was something like, realistically, you can't laugh solidly for more than 40 minutes.
Yeah.
So when you've got the hour, you have to craft something in the middle where people are not going to be laughing.
Yeah.
Laugh, 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 laugh. Which for somebody used to the club is a really nerve-wracking thing to do.
It's so vulnerable. I really envy kind of festival-y comics who don't really do the clubs because they have no inhibitions about their gag rate.
Yeah.
But then also snobbishly, myself and a lot of other club comedians are like, can you make the gag rate? Like if you did have to have a gag every 10 to 30 seconds, as is industry standard, could you do it? I don't know.
So you've talked a little bit, so the this year's show is the first hour, right?
Yeah.
And when did you decide, so 2023 you did the 45 minutes?
Yeah.
And when did you decide 2025 I'm going to come and do
I don't, well, I mean, loads of it is money. It's really boring. I'd love to say like, oh, I was waiting for the socio-political landscape to adhere nicely to the themes of my show. I just needed to save money for a bit longer.
Needed a spreadsheet to add up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with the hour, I mean, you've already mentioned the sort of the poetry element to the show. I mean, to what extent is it pulling from your club material and putting that in together so it has a narrative, or to what extent did you start with a blank page? It's like, okay, Edinburgh, I'm going to come with something completely different.
I think the blank page is so scary. And I also, as everybody does, wanted the show to be funny. So I thought, definitely let's put all the club material in and make a framework, you know, use that to hang other stuff off of. But I was also really keen, because I have a theatre degree, I was like, I want to show people that I can, I'm not just club comic who calls people nonces in the front row and does the job and goes home. I can be more kind of nuanced than that. So yeah, I was like, let's put the club material as the pillars of the show. But then I really want to do some fantasy stuff, like songs and poems and impressions, and just show the other strings to my bow a little bit.
And that other stuff, like the poetry you've already mentioned, is that stuff you've done on stage before, or is that brand new for the...
That's all new this year, but actually, and I thought that I would never be able to do it in the clubs, but I actually can, and that's gorgeous. It's so freeing. And I think this is what I mean about growing up, being forged in the fires of the clubs, to an extent, you feel like there's a bit of a tourniquet on your experimentation. And so it's really nice to just have the space and freedom and authority, because there's no promoter watching from the sidelines going like, oh, she's overrun or she's not doing what I wanted. Just to be able to be like, I'm going to do some poems, and then to take them to the clubs and they work in the clubs. That was such a lovely surprise.
Obviously, you've mentioned the budgeting considerations. Obviously, that's always with Edinburgh. It is expensive to bring a show here. But I mean, do you, budgets aside, do you sort of see you at the next phase of your career being that where, whether it's every year or it's every other year, you are coming and doing another hour and doing something different? Will this now be part of your journey for the next few years?
I think so. I think if you'd asked me 6 months ago, I would have said, I'm going to do this big fancy debut with all the bells and whistles attached, and then I'm going to leave Edinburgh alone. But it's going way better than I thought it was going to go. And I think it's not going to be as financially ruinous as I thought it was going to be. I think there's a little bit of hysteria. I mean, don't get me wrong, the Fringe is overpriced. It's elitist. It's a playground for rich kids, unfortunately. But it's not. I'm not going to lose 10 grand down the drain and have no rewards for that in the way that I thought I might do about 6 months ago. So I think probably every other year is comfortable for me.
Beyond the Edinburgh shows, what are the future plans? Obviously, more club sets, obviously. Yeah. That's a big part of it, what you do. But do you have future plans and or ambitions to sort of...
Yeah, it's tricky because I think some people do their show and they want club promoters to come so that they can get club spots. And I don't mean to brag, but I am in the clubs.
Yeah,
I
you don't need ready. That.
Don't need that. I want to show people the diverse part of me. I really want to travel the world, so I want the festival guys to come. I want to go and take the show. Now that my faith in the show has been bolstered so much since I started to... If you'd asked me in July, I would have said, well, unfortunately, the show is not really good enough for anyone to give a shit about it. But now I'm like, actually, the show's really good and I love doing it. So let me take it and show it off around Sydney and Melbourne and Adelaide and New Zealand and Canada and everywhere, you know. So that's a big part of it.
I'm just going to sort of that change of confidence in the show. Is that because the show's evolved a lot over that time, or simply because by putting it in front of an audience every day, you're like, actually, you know what?
Yeah.
I was wrong to be touting myself.
I think both. I think it has to be both. I think doing whips, when you're not famous and you can't have really well-attended buzzy whips, and you're doing these work-in-progress shows to six people who didn't even know that this was what they were going to see, that's, I think, the worst thing you can do to make yourself feel good about... I can't believe we put ourselves through the ringer of doing endless work in progresses. And I just was like, these aren't going that great. The show's obviously rubbish. But then, and then my first night, my flyering team got it wrong. And as in, they thought that I was starting the next day, so they didn't fly. So I had two people from HMRC and I played the show to them.
Blimey.
Yeah, they loved it actually. And they still follow me online. But I was like, it just affirmed like, oh my God, it is bad. And I was right, and I shouldn't be.
For your first night, that's pretty...
It's really tough.
Because I've known the Fringe for many years.
Yeah.
That happens, and I have been in the audience of five or six, and I'm always in awe. I think it's the one art for any other... I mean, obviously, theatre, music, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody wants to play to an empty room.
But comedy is the art form.
It's the most painful one.
Where it's like, but the room is part of the show. Whereas a gig can happen with no one in the room. No one enjoys it, but it can happen. Whereas
the room's so conversational and interactive as a comic as well. So without people to bounce off. But then, so they really liked it. And then after that, numbers have been 100 times better than I thought they would be. And my audience reviews, I mean, a lot of my reviews haven't been published yet, which is really annoying. So I don't know about the critical response at this stage, but my audience, I'm sorry to say, if you hate people at Bragg, my audience love the show.
Yeah.
And the reviews I'm getting and the DMs I'm getting is just is like an elixir. It's perfect and it's addictive. And I just want that forever.
So that's really cool. So yeah, we need to get that show out beyond August into many different places as possible. Well, let's do the listings for the show. So tell me the remind us the name, the venue, the time.
Yes. So the show is called Don't Make Me Regret This. I am Jessie Nixon. My show is on at 7:20 every day, apart from the final 25th of August, that Monday I didn't want to do. And it's on in The Crate, which is behind the Gordon Aikman building, just off of Assembly George Square. It's an Assembly show. Assembly is fantastic to work with, by the way. Huge love to Assembly.
Thank you for them donating me a space to record these podcasts.
Exactly. That's perfect. But yeah, that's all the deets. And please come.
And where do people find you online?
Oh, they can find me on mainly Instagram and occasionally TikTok at Jessie Nixon Comedy.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.